This episode of Policing Matters is brought to you by Lexipol, the experts in policy, training, wellness support, and grants assistance for first responders and government leaders. To learn more, visit lexipol.com. That's LEXIPOL.com. Hey, welcome back to Policing Matters on police1.com. I'm your host, Jim Dudley. Hopefully you are checking us out on the YouTube channel as well, so you can see me and our guest today. Well, most law enforcement veterans who have been in the business for more than 10 years or so have anecdotal experience with terms such as the Ferguson effect, George Floyd, and depolicing. My guests today are researchers who conducted a study on depolicing with very interesting results. Our guests today are Dr. Charles Scheer, Dr. Michael Rossler, and Jacob Foster. Dr. Charlie Scheer is an associate professor of criminal justice at the University of Southern Mississippi. His research specializations are police workforce management, police training, and police leadership pathways. Welcome, Dr. Scheer.
Good morning.
And Dr. Michael T. Rossler is an assistant professor in the Department of Criminal Justice Studies at Illinois State University. Welcome, Dr. Rossler.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
And Jacob Foster is a doctoral student, soon to be Dr. Foster, within the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice at Arizona State University. Their full bios are listed below in the show notes, along with some links to articles and some upcoming work. Well, the three of you, I know you're working on busy schedules. I appreciate you being here. It's important to understand the issues. Tell us about the study and what was the impetus behind the study behind it. Why'd you look into it?
Yeah, I guess I'll start. So I was working for Mike at the time, and we both read this book by Dr. Willard Oliver. It's titled Depolicing When Officers Disengage. In that book, Dr. Willard Oliver, who's also a former police officer himself, he conducted 60 interviews with cops on the depolicing phenomenon. And I think what stood out to me was that especially this last decade, there's been a lot of focus on how police are publicly, you know, scrutinized and how that would maybe impact their behavior. But a lot of these behaviors, you know, at its core, you know, the disengagement from proactive behavior has really manifested in a lot of different ways over time. You know, you think of police shirking, you know, and officers maybe go back on their duties and neglect them slightly. You know, it could be manifested because of maybe low morale or organizational culture, or it's the blue flu. You know, officers are calling in sick to maybe avoid some type of responsibility and response to something. Or, you know, more recently is, you know, you hear about the Ferguson effect, which, you know, put in just simply is referring to that idea that, you know, because of increased scrutiny of police, you know, particularly deriving from high profile cases such as, you know, excessive use of force, can lead to a phenomenon where, you know, police officers become less proactive for a period of time. And so, you know, it started out as my master's thesis, but we ended up, you know, turning this into a publication. We really just wanted to examine the depolicing phenomenon, you know, by collectively examining a lot of these relevant predictors that would make an officer want to disengage from being proactive. Mike Rossler could probably do a better job of explaining, you know, how we collected our data.
Yeah, so I mean, this is kind of like a part of a study that we've been working on. Initially, we looked at recruitment issues with college students and whether they want to become police officers or not. Then obviously the other part of that organizational management is keeping officers around. So we were interested in retention, and Charlie was able to make some connections with 8 different police departments. The first 3 we did online because COVID restrictions, our universities wouldn't let us travel. And so we sent out those online surveys to Topeka, Kansas, Vernon Hills, Illinois, and Smyrna, Georgia. And then from there, everything kind of opened up and we were able to do some site visits. I think Charlie did the bulk of those, but he visited Biloxi, Frederick, Maryland, We both went to Thornton, Colorado, and then he did Bryan, Texas, and Portland. And so those were kind of throughout 2021. So part of it, we were in COVID lockdown, and then part of it, we're actually able to do site visits. And so just want to say thanks to those departments and the officers who took that survey, because it's a challenging area to do research in, and they were very welcoming to us.
That's great, Charlie. Any resistance from those agencies, or how'd you get? Were they volunteers or voluntold to participate?
No, that's actually a fine line when you're doing a research project, Jim. As you know, there have been times when I have collected data for other projects when you're sitting there with a survey in your hand and you're at a briefing and somebody will walk down and say, this is coming from the top floor, here's a survey. That really wasn't the case for us. If anything, we were actually turned, I feel, relatively loose to, inform the officers at their briefing, and in some cases went to them if they were, say, sworn officers in CID or detectives, other special units. We did have an opportunity to explain our research one-on-one with them in a manner that was underneath the gaze or aside from the gaze of their command staff. And therefore, the results that we got, and this is very interesting to me, was about the most well-rounded and diverse group of officers in a nationwide sample that I feel has been conducted for a retention study of this fashion in the modern era. There hasn't been very much done in that regard, and I'd like to look at what we were able to accomplish because of the COVID restrictions being just immediately in the rearview mirror as a pretty informative and important exercise, interviewing and talking to people, and then getting back in touch with people that were maybe had just left the department. We couldn't do that part of the study. We had to kind of focus only on that survey aspect because we weren't allowed to go beyond that because of COVID restrictions. But what we ended up doing for the study was pretty fruitful.
That's great. And so you talk about six tested drivers. Who's going to talk about that?
Sure, I can do it. So a lot of the discussion around the depolicing phenomenon revolves around public scrutiny. We wanted to capture, whether officers have concerns that either law enforcement or themselves or maybe their department could be portrayed by news media outlets. And news outlets are often the ones who are, reporting on incidences that are involving police, including cases of, any alleged misconduct, a use of force, or perhaps even, relations with the community. And so we combine these items together that are really focusing on whether officers personally fear negative media attention because of their job, or whether they, the department, how it's portrayed in the news media, or how law enforcement as a profession is being portrayed. Our second one is liability concerns. And we're really getting at how we're referring to the potential financial obligations that law enforcement agencies or officers may face in their career. It's difficult to determine the actual number of lawsuits against the police, but officer concerns over the consequences of their actions or interacting with citizens, such as citizen complaints, termination of employment, false accusations, have been well documented in prior research. So we're really focusing on perceptions of being sued, or officers having to being apprehensive about potentially having to purchase liability insurance, or they're afraid of being sued. Our third one is, organizational unfairness, and there are a few ways in which an officer could experience organizational unfairness. Different ways that can manifest, but we're more getting at how officers are treated by, their direct supervisors. And so we're focusing on this could be in the form of, where they experience unprofessional treatment, maybe derogatory remarks or condescending comments. And the idea here would be that if an officer is experiencing these issues with their supervisor, then maybe that could potentially make them more inclined to want to disengage from their work. Number four would be, burnout. Many empirical studies will allude to the fact that policing is just a stressful job. Numerous studies suggest that, you know, officers experience, you know, really, really heavy workloads, you know, poor sleep quality, maybe PTSD. You know, taking these collectively, you know, it can really have an impact on an officer's mental health. Our fifth one is physical danger. So obviously there are dangerous aspects of a career in law enforcement. At certain points in an officer's career, there might be instances in which, you know, maybe a suspect presents some type of threat to the officer or the other or others in the community. And so it was really worthwhile for us to examine how these perceptions of danger can maybe be linked to the inclination to disengage from proactive policing. And finally, I mean, as Mike and Charlie were kind of discussing, I mean, given the timing in which the data was being collected, we want to make sure that we make an attempt to capture whether officers have concerns of contracting COVID. You know, what distinguished policing from a lot of careers during the time was a lot of occupations were able to move into this virtual format. A lot of people were being able to work from home, but that obviously wasn't true for officers. They weren't able to mitigate that any health threats by working from home. So there were very limited findings to suggest that, you know, maybe some officers did have concerns of contracting COVID or maybe contracting and bringing it home to their families. But more importantly, some groups even recommended, you know, the police agencies maybe reduce their stops in order to mitigate, you know, any exposure. Apart from those six drivers, I do want to, you know, point out that our outcome, what we're looking at, you know, these depolicing is really just based on officer perception. So we're not necessarily, you know, measuring actual behavior, right? But we're really getting at, you know, whether officers were hesitant, you know, to perform arrests, searches, or be generally proactive.
Yeah, and so of the six that you name, I think three, to me, I personally think three, the lawsuit threat is real, because not only you're worried about your own personal liability and your reputation, but also the impact it has on your job security going forward or promotions, things like that. But the media scrutiny, I mean, you know, media goes up and down in their perception of policing. And you know, after 9/11, we're riding the wave, right? So we had really good public and media perception and support. But when you did this study, were you looking at a specific timeline, or were you looking just at the impact from Ferguson, George Floyd, COVID going forward? What was your timeline for that?
Yeah, so we were doing, do you want to go ahead, Charlie, or do you want me to do it? We were doing it in 2021, so this is a very close to post-George Floyd period, and we did have questions that were specifically focused on George Floyd, but we wanted to have a more kind of global measure of public scrutiny and the experiences that officers were having with that versus tying it into a single thing. And so, I mean, you lose a little bit of context there from tying it to a specific event, but I think you gain something in terms of contributing to science by focusing it that way. And so it was a more universal than tied to anything specific.
I also think, you know, as you know, Jim, it's very hard to disentangle just exactly what was going on in the mind of a cop back in 2021 and two. It, you know, at that time, it could basically be that these things maybe contributed in some, you know, latent fashion to just a dissatisfaction with their career choice or the consideration of something else. But our survey didn't treat it that way. We actually did have specific questions about Floyd, COVID, and other events, as well as things that didn't tap into the historical importance of those specific events, but stuff that was traditional and would normally be encountered in other careers, such as workplace culture, a relationship with one's supervisor. So we did in the survey make as good an attempt, and I think it was successful, to disentangle the environment of 2021 and two by putting things in specific question form. As to whether or not, you know, an individual officer in a briefing taking a survey is able to perceive that, that's going to be dependent upon a lot of things. But I think, you know, that's a threat to the validity of your study, regardless of whether it's police or if we were, you know, studying the job satisfaction of, you know, high school teachers when we're asking them at 2:30, you know, are you ready to go home? So there was a lot of stuff going on, but we did a very good job, I think, of, you know, disentangling that with our questioning.
I see. So what stood out? Let's just go down the line, Charlie, Mike, and then Jacob. What stood out as maybe an aha moment in the findings, or did you get what you expected?
Mike, I can talk a little bit about these two. I did feel like there's a distance, if you will, between the officers we spoke to, and I think that it does have an impact on their career considerations, between some of these events and what they deal with day to day. I'm not entirely ready to say that the historical importance of the events that, you know, we wanted to measure was at the forefront of their mind when they are writing a report, conducting a traffic stop, interacting with the public because of a complaint, or even some of the positive things officers do. Like you were saying, Jim, I think that that's dependent upon the officer's mindset for other reasons. And Mike actually did kind of put together, you know, some articles and things that I think did spell out for us on the front end, you know, what to expect. But I don't think, as you know, I look back on this study and I look at the sort of bird's eye view of it. There wasn't any smoking gun, if you will, Jim, that to me indicated, but there were some surprising findings. Mike, do you want to talk about those?
I mean, for our research, I'll take a couple of them and then I'll leave a few for Jake, because I'm sure he's got some input too. One that I've been struggling with is the lack of a significant finding for organizational unfairness. And so looking at the previous literature and what police officers say in interviews, it's if you feel supported by your supervisor, you're going to be more willing to go out and take those proactive actions because you know that somebody has your back. And so if you engage in some type of behavior and then you experience a lawsuit and it gets settled by the city or settled by the department, you might feel like that's an admission of wrongdoing. Or if every time something happens, your political city government puts the burden back on you or pushes back on you, you might be less willing to engage in these types of proactive policing behaviors. But we didn't find a significant finding for that. We did find significant findings between departments, but nothing specifically tied to organizational unfairness. And so that was one that was really surprising for me, that it didn't seem to matter how your supervisor supported you in terms of whether you're going to continue to engage in searches and stops and arrests.
Yeah, I would also throw in the fact that when you talk about the George Floyd incident, I don't think that we made any attempt to statistically relate George Floyd to depolicing, Jim, but we did notice that there was an effect of the George Floyd incident on individual thoughts about maintaining the policing career as a whole. I think, Mike, it was just over half of our questions or our responses to whether or not George Floyd incident would make them reconsider their police career was either a strongly or just basically agree with statement. So for, you know, just over half of the officers that we, and this is a national study, Jim, to say, yes, that, you know, that incident was powerful enough for me to reconsider my career, does suggest that maybe there would be a relationship to their productivity or other things, but it wasn't considered by our study as having a bearing on deep policing.
Jake, anything?
Yeah, absolutely. I think like one thing is liability concerns, as you were mentioning, you know, Jim, we found that it was statistically significant, So, you know, this could be the link that's showing that officers, you know, not only care about, you know, their reputation, but certainly that economic risk associated with engaging with community members. And I also consider, you know, other factors, as you probably know, that there have been some discussions about, you know, people trying to push towards the end of qualified immunity for officers.
Lexapol, you know, empowers first responders and public servants to best meet the needs of their residents,
you know,
safely and responsibly, serving more than 2 million public safety and government professionals,
you know,
and over 8,000
you know,
agencies and municipalities. Lexapol offers a range of,
you know,
solutions
officers,
that includes,
you know,
policies, training,
about, well,
behavioral health resources, news
know,
and analysis,
engaging,
and grant assistance
right? I
services
think another
for
thing
law enforcement,
is, you know,
fire and rescue,
as I mentioned earlier,
EMS,
a lot of discussions
local
around
government,
scrutiny.
And other agencies
that's something
dedicated
else that we found,
to public safety.
You know,
to learn more, visit lexapol.com. That's
and I think there's been an influx of a few things, especially this last decade. So obviously, you know, the widespread implementation of body-worn cameras, taking that, you know, coupled with social media outlets and any interaction with the police, it's very easy to be distributed among the general public as well as the news now, compared to many decades prior. And so it's really easy for, you know, officers to, you know, observe news media or other media sources, you know, that might depict law enforcement being portrayed negatively, or, you know, officers, you know, may either witness protests on news media or personally witness that themselves, might make them more inclined to depolice. And one final thing I would want to add is just, you know, some of those drivers that we were talking about, Jim, I mean, not all of those, you know, taken as a sample collectively, were statistically significant. I don't want to necessarily downplay, you know, the factors that we didn't find to be, you know, I think there are differences across departments, you know, depolicing, and I don't think we've necessarily included all the factors. Probably, you know, many others, you know, might be compacted to make an officer want to disengage, but, you know, you have to consider, you know, the characteristics of, you know, the agency themselves, surrounding area, you know, whether protests were recent or not, maybe the workload of officers, you know, how they're treated by their peers or, you know, their supervisors. And so this could be, you know, widespread thing, but it certainly could be manifest at different levels, you know, depending on the agency or the individual officer.
Yeah, we also saw, and I wanted to kind of piggyback off that for a second. When it comes to COVID, Jim, an interesting and somewhat intriguing finding, which suggests that there is a relationship between the agency's COVID protocols and behaviors. Officers that are more concerned about COVID would be less inclined for proactive type behavior. Not necessarily an impact on depolicing, but an indication, and I think, you know, Mike's notes were that it was a snapshot in time. I love that analogy. It makes you reflect back to a time when the mystery of what was going on, and I think all of the American public was, you know, kind of mired in this mystery, was such that, you know, especially in light of, you know, the various illnesses that were happening to loved ones, you know, we did, I think, go through as a nation, you know, a feeling that, you know, if I'm really concerned about this, the more my concern, the less inclined I'm going to be to engage. Not necessarily an indication of depolicing, but of a fear that was prevalent at that time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, in response to what Jake said, the idea of do nothing wrong became, you know, a rally cry among, you know, the frontline officers. But in almost everything we do in policing, it all seems to lead back to leadership. And after COVID or during COVID, we had so many chiefs leave the profession. And whether it was a planned retirement or not, I think... you know, such confusing times. We need to benchmark 2020, 2021 as so many significant things happening. And when the leadership was either leaving or acquiescing to public requests to do less, I think frontline officers took lessons from that and took that as their marching orders. But there were also these, if you remember the Black Lives Matter protests, public protests, asking police chiefs and officers to kneel in public. Cops didn't know if they should or shouldn't. They were the frontline people dealing with people violating the COVID restrictions, sometimes with masks, sometimes with not. And then afterwards, some of them were fired for not complying with the vaccination rules. So really confusing times for cops. And I think I would, my personal feeling after talking with so many cops, having a family in the business still, that if you didn't proactively do anything, you weren't putting yourself at risk. You weren't exposing yourself. I think, like I said, so many variables, but leadership, I think the agencies that really survived seem to have good, strong leadership with clear messaging to their troops. And in your surveys, you're asking cops to come in and speak, you know, honestly and frankly with you. Did you get the feeling that they were being upfront about their leadership, or knowing cops, probably not, so forthright to say, yeah, we have a terrible chief, or we had awful direction? Did you come across anything like that?
I actually think the opposite, Jim. I have to reflect back to a couple of things, and I want to say one other thing about your comment about, you know, the COVID times. We here in Mississippi had a tremendously powerful tornado. I think it was the third largest or widest in the history of the United States, and recorded, it was just several miles wide, that occurred during the lockdown week. It was Easter Sunday of 2020, and you had a number of first responders that were really, you know, we were told to stay in our homes. You know, what are we supposed to be doing? And you go back to your leadership messaging. I think that there were some people that reverted to, you know, the community need and the immediate, you know, there's actually a fatality in that tornado of a deputy in the county that I live in. So there was I think, like, over time, and this also resulted in some of the research work we did, you know, following that, because it was about a year and a half after the COVID that we were in Portland, where we did see people that were willing to, and I don't want to use a term that I think is really appropriate, to open up a discussion about the leadership of that era. No one, it seemed to me, and Mike, you could probably, we may differ on this, I don't know. It didn't seem to me as though it was a response that was overwhelmingly negative about the leadership during this time. I think there obviously would have been some concerns, although we didn't address them directly with all survey takers, about the political winds of that time. But when it came to command staff and their sort of acceptability, and you know, granted, we weren't talking about depolicing, but in job satisfaction and you know, whether or not they felt as though their career choice was one they wanted to sustain, there wasn't anything that struck me, Mike, about that time as, you know, I'm being driven out by poor decision making at the top. What do you think?
No, I think some of that's an artifact of the departments that we were in. Like, I don't think that they had extremely problematic leadership. They seem to be fairly stable. And I think that's, you know, part of it. If we went to a department where things were a total mess, then I might consider whether our results were reliable and valid or not. But doing some of the analyses, it seems like officers were honest about it. It seems like we had enough of a percentage that were concerned about, you know, their direct supervisor or command staff or other issues with their coworkers in the organization, that it seemed to reflect the reality of the departments that we were in. And so I don't think, you know, there might be some of that kind of social desirability stuff going on where it's like, I'm not going to say anything bad about my department or police, but I think when you hand somebody a survey and there's 60 or 70 people taking it and there's no leadership in the room, and you're like, hey, if you don't want to take it, you don't have to. We've all been in situations where people just walk out and laugh at you too, right? And police officers aren't shy about doing that. None of them that I've ran into. And so I think people were excited that we were interested in these topics and not, you know, something else. And so I think we got a lot of good participation about that. And then there's always those casual conversations with people in the briefing rooms and hallways and stuff after you do it. And they weren't shy about expressing their feelings there, whether they were good, bad, or indifferent, just the way it went.
The novelty of the study's topic was also adding to their frankness. You know, if you're going to ask an officer about their career pathway, and, you know, obviously the legitimacy of what Mike and I were doing at that, you know, time was, we're outsiders, we're, you know, from Mississippi and Illinois, to professors. And, you know, I myself, you know, been an officer in the past. I think that that also added, Jim, to a sort of, okay, yeah, I can open up here about. So I didn't think that any of the responses were necessarily canned, or there was definitely some candor that was going on.
Great.
Yeah, Jake and I had a few conversations about the depolicing aspects of that too. And so I think we actually ended up including a couple questions where we asked if they witnessed other officers engaging in it, because we thought they might be afraid to say that they did it, or not say that they did it, but say that they observed somebody else doing it. And I think those things tended to be pretty honest, and they were pretty related to the officers who admitted doing it themselves, also admitted that other people were doing it. And so I think that kind of points towards the reliability of our measures, not only on the organizational side, but also the outcome of depolicing behavior, because we were a little worried that people weren't going to admit that they were holding back on proactive engagement with the public.
So going back to the liability question a little bit, I want to know if you asked about fear of prosecution, or if that's only happening in you know, some small areas of the country where you know, for lack of a better word, liberal or progressive district attorneys come in, say we're going to focus on bad cops. In San Francisco, we had a DA who charged five separate cases against police officers, from excessive force to manslaughter. And one case was adjudicated, and all the others were dropped after a new DA came in, after that one was recalled. I know we've seen something similar in the Baltimore area, other areas of the country. Did that ever enter into the conversation?
I know with the just simply this study, we weren't really considering criminal liability. That doesn't mean it's not relevant. You know, we were focusing on a little bit more broader measure on civil liability, you know, with officers, you know, having apprehension of purchasing liability insurance, or, you know, fear of being sued. You know, though I would speculate, Jim, how, you know, results would look different, you know, if we try to parse out, you know, those concerns of being held civilly liable or criminally, you know, with being prosecuted. It would also be really interesting to see, you know, if there's any abrupt changes, and maybe just at an agency, you know, or officer perceptions or their behaviors, you know, following, you know, a lawsuit of an officer, they may have known, or themselves. There's not a great deal of prior research or theory setting, you know, that liability concern as a predictor, but you know, historically, it's been, and it's still uncommon for police officers to necessarily be criminally charged for actions they take in line of duty outside of something like economic corruption. But a substantial number of officers probably have someone close to them in the department who has been sued.
Yeah, I was thinking along the lines of after George Floyd, nationally, there was a critical look at the carotid restraint and other neck restraints. So, through DOJ recommendations, so many departments abandoned or forbid the use of carotid restraints, and even to the point where NYPD for a time had a misdemeanor law that said if you place your body on any part of a suspect while attempting to restrain him, could result in misdemeanor charges. That was repealed almost immediately. But depolicing, as far as if they're holding up George Floyd as that one incident that the media is really holding on to, the lack of restraint or the response, saying they didn't want to put hands on to resisting suspects anymore, was the physical part of the job ever brought up in the interviews?
Yeah, I think that when you're meeting with a briefing, as we were, Jim, and this is actually something that I have over the years of doing things from the research and academic side, it is somewhat frustrating that we cannot ask questions on a basis that would be directly, I guess, like addressing issues that are always on the front burner. You know, there's a revolving door of issues that it seems like research is just having to play catch up. And that is something that I find kind of fascinating about it, but it is definitely a hindrance to understanding. In 2021, you know, I think that we were really interested in an exploratory study of retention, the direct impact of political and legal miscommunication. I'm using a very, you know, vanilla word there, between the front lines and what they perceive to be administrative/legal support or lack of support, is something that we really couldn't foresee until we had kind of a basic understanding of what was going on, the basic landscape, if you will. However, that is not to suggest that somewhere there needs to be a more direct assessment of issues like that in specific areas of the country where you and I know there is tension and has historically been tension. When we were in Portland, it was evident that there were specific people on the city's political leadership that the Portland Police Bureau officers were apt to say, you know, if not for those individuals. So this is something that we just couldn't foresee, nor did we ask, but I think leaves the door wide open for a tremendous future effort on our part or some other researcher to look at those things. And I also just want to add that, you know, before we came on here, you and I were a part of just such an informal study on the part of Police One to look at stuff like that. And yet the impact of that is still not, I think, empirically sound like it could be. An effort to look at the political support or perception of lack of it on police depolicing or regular behavior or even career pathways is some, or another thing would be very interesting to me is to look at recruits. You know, are you dissuaded from getting into this because you've heard of something? What have you heard? We just haven't gotten to the point where we've asked those questions just yet.
Yeah, that's a great point. Well, I'd like to ask more about the process and the outcomes, but first I'd like to take a moment and thank our sponsor. Lexapol empowers first responders and public servants to best meet the needs of their residents safely and responsibly, serving more than 2 million public safety and government professionals in over 8,000 agencies and municipalities. Lexapol offers a range of solutions that includes policies, training, behavioral health resources, news and analysis, and grant assistance services for law enforcement, fire and rescue, EMS, local government, and other agencies dedicated to public safety. To learn more, visit lexipol.com. That's LEXIPOL.com. And we're back, and I'm speaking with Dr. Charles Shearer, Dr. Michael Rossley, and Jacob Foster about their study on the effects of depolicing. And so far, what have we seen as external influences and how they impact depolicing? Some states have decriminalized drugs, raised theft thresholds from $400 to $500 to $1,200 in some places. In California, we made jaywalking legal, for instance, and there's been other barriers placed on Terry stops and pretext traffic stops. Certainly, if they are policy and law changes, they have made impact, haven't they? When from above, we just talked about the legislative arm, they're telling cops, hey, we don't want you to do that so much anymore. Did that come up in your interviews?
Mike, you want to talk about that one?
That's not something that we really covered very in depth. I guess that's, you know, the police have always been responding to public sentiment in that way and responding to the law, right? There's a lot of different restrictions that have been placed on police discretion, and we were more interested in, you know, what are they doing proactively, not so much once these legislative controls on discretion happen, how do officers respond to that type of stuff? And so, I mean, there's been situations where those go into place, like Tennessee versus Garner, and it ends up being a wonderful thing, right? These controls on discretion, and it boosts public morale. And some of these things, I think you could explain just by like inflation, right? So if you're moving those thresholds of how much is stolen, I think that's kind of like following along and trying to track with justice. And maybe it's just public sentiment articulating when and where they want police to intervene as far as things like jaywalking. I think that's always kind of been a department by department thing. It's one of the examples I use in my classes. Like if you're jaywalking here on campus, you're probably going to get a ticket. A lot of my students come from Northern Illinois, and I'm like, would you ever get a jaywalking ticket in Chicago? And they're like, never, ever, ever. like there's way too many things going on. And this is just, I think, a case-by-case and community basis.
Yeah, I actually agree. And I think about some other cities here regionally in the Gulf Coast that have very wildly differential policies with regard to what sort of enforcement is going to take place when. There is a much different environment in the Gulf Coast during Mardi Gras that there is, you know, and during the summers than there would be during specific other events. Jim, I think that there's, again, you know, some room to sort of make some other hypotheses about, you know, what might affect officer behavior from a procedural and policy standpoint. With regard to some of those things that you mentioned, I would be very interested to see a study of how these events that we've been talking about, COVID, George Floyd incident, et cetera, on changes in departmental policy. To my knowledge, there hasn't really been a definitive study of the effect of the events of 2020 through 2022 on police policies that were enacted, you know, at the top, or you know, tension about specific policies that may have taken place. That would be something that would guide, I think, a future discussion of whether or not officers, once those policies, you know, were laid down, you know, were they going to leave and go to another department? Were they considering, abandoning policing as a profession? Or in the case of, you know, Jake's article, you know, would it just affect their, you know, individual reaction to certain incidents and cases of you know, interaction with the public? Mm-hmm. We don't have that yet.
Yeah, and I think my question goes more to the heart of morale as being, do they feel supported with the erosion of laws that make otherwise negative up to criminal behavior, something that they would have proactively pursued in the past? A car driving without license plate in attempt to evade ALPRs, to pull a carjacking or a mass theft from retail. We're seeing much more of that today. That they're being stripped of tools that may seem super low level, but that they can use for those pretext stops or to engage in suspicious behavior based on something they can hang their hat on, a local law, a traffic law, or a misdemeanor. But I think the message that a lot of cops I'm hearing from say that the message is clear. They want the police to pull back and not be so engaged. And I think anecdotally, I get the feeling that cops are withdrawing because that's the message they're receiving.
Yeah, that's an interesting statement that does have a lot of validity from at least my perspective, because I used to be that officer. I was on an interdiction team. I worked, a pretext stop is our bread and butter back in the, 2000s for that type of work, the technology that they have now that makes it almost, laughable that was the sort of thing that we did, which produced, on the one hand, lots of interaction for narcotics interdiction, but also produced an abrasion with the segment of the public that it appears now that departmental policy is trying to preserve, and with good reason. So it makes me wonder about just how valid some of that anecdote would be on a grander scale nationally, outside of the places that you and I, and I think we all can say we've very apprised of things that are going on in certain jurisdictions of that nature. And we've seen, and like you use the word erosion, I think you could even be more particular to say that, at least from the political standpoint of some of these officers, they feel somewhat offended that rug is pulled out from under them. And that's a very valid point that we don't have a whole lot of empirical support for just yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and going back to Sir Robert Peel and the idea that prevention should be the number one priority of police, not making arrests, that when you take away these kinds of things, you take away that prevention aspect. And your study in depolicing takes away that dimension of proactive policing and in the attempt to prevent crime. No question there. So
I agree with you. And I think also you could add another dimension that we examined in the original study, which was going back to your statement about morale, we tried to break morale down into very infinitesimal things like, one of the things that we haven't even scratched the surface of with our results is the perception that they're bullied by their supervisor. Well, what does that entail in 2023, et cetera, for, do we have a relationship that is consistent with the relationship that I had with my supervisor in the 2000s, or is this a new dimension, a new generation, and things that have evolved to the point they are now are always going to be sort of up for discussion. Mike and I haven't even gotten to the point where we've looked at that variable as, intricately as I think we could. So again, a robust data set with just a finite amount of time that we can to dig into it, but we're getting there.
And so from your study, do you see this as a blip in the history of policing, or is this a landmark situation, this point in time where going forward, we can expect to see less proactive policing?
I mean, I would hesitate to call anything that we do a landmark. Like, for me, that seems like out of place. I would put it in the context of what our goals were. And so historically, this has been something that's been mentioned, right? Like, I don't think police officers having an issue with something going on in their environment and then temporarily withdrawing from certain behaviors is unusual. I think that's been going on since we started studying police as an institution in the 50s and the 60s. I think our contribution here is kind of explaining why this is happening, because there's always been evidence that it happens, and it's kind of an ebb and flow. And sometimes officers are going to be more proactive and sometimes they're going to be less proactive. And ultimately, we're trying to explain why that might be the case. Is it actually the things that they're saying? And can we relate that kind of numerically? I think that there's also some opportunities to kind of reframe what proactivity is. Because of course there's people who are going to call the police and they want the police there and they want the police to intervene. And then there's people who are not going to call the police, and you might still be in a place where you need some type of police intervention in your neighborhood, but you don't want to call them or you're afraid to call them. And how can we have the police engage in proactive activities that the community still supports and appreciates? And some of those laws that you mentioned might help kind of define those boundaries about when you want the police to intervene and what you want them to be doing, while still not necessarily being bold enough to call them if you're in a community where you have a high level of fear about actually asking the police to come help you out.
Yeah, I also wanted to illustrate that with Jake's article being the beginning of that scale, if you will. If there's a continuum of outcomes from all of these events on police thoughts, behaviors, career plans, Jake's concern with just how that may affect your individual reaction to specific calls, public interactions, not I'm leaving, I'm going to work at some other venue, or even worse, I'm going to leave the profession entirely. So what we really did find out from, I think, the biggest contribution I feel the study made was to take morale and look at it on a scale, if you will, reacting to these, events and others, ones like I said, the prior question, we have a whole lot of work to do to continue to evaluate that on a continuum, if you will, of possible outcomes related to the career, from I like my job well enough to stay, but this today I'm just not having it because I'm mad about something I read and I'm just going to, pull back or what have you, to I'm getting out of here, I'm getting a resume, I'm gone, I'm leaving the profession. And what I think we found there, Jim, was a kind of a mixed bag, if you will. In places that I would have thought people would have been leaving the profession, we did not see, we talked from the previous, article, this leaving in droves was not supported by the evidence from our study. Nor do I feel as though we saw a tremendous effort to shirk. It was not really as obvious either, but some, as we stated before, impact of the individual venues that we looked at, but also, the as Mike said, it's a continuum, and these strategies are going to be, always continually evolving. So more than just an implication of the importance of leadership and policy, but also the times, it's very difficult to predict, what's around the corner. Both Mike and myself are in the business of, working in a college environment where we do have a number of students that are interested in careers in policing, and to sort of be involved in this, not just from a research standpoint, but from a teaching standpoint, gives us a unique perspective. And I can tell you, at least from my thoughts, and it may be just anecdotal in the classroom, but it's borne out by some of the research, that the future is not as negative as, there are some people that are painting it. And I do think there's work to be done, however, and as to what that entails is going to be on the doorstep of leadership for many years to come.
Well, that's good to hear.
I would just add one, one quick thing, Jim, with what Charlie and Mike are saying. I think that, as like policing, throughout decades has changed, right? There's been police trainings, how we interact with the public, it changes. There's been technological advancements, right, that have brought about different changes, policy, legislation, and police departments have had to adapt to that. And well, there's been events that have changed, how the public or the police, perceive and respond to certain events as well.
Well, hey, I appreciate all your time. You guys are really busy and doing great work in criminal justice. Charlie Scheer at the University of Southern Mississippi, thanks for taking time to come on today.
Really glad to be here. Thank you for inviting us, Jim.
Hey, what do you have, Charlie? What are you working on these days?
Well, I don't know we're at the very beginning of a study that I feel is taking the concept of recruiting and retention into an area that has been long neglected, and that is a sort of a study of how personnel management, especially at this time, may be affecting preparation for leadership roles and succession planning in police departments. I think that there's a lot of emphasis on strategies for recruiting, and that's definitely something that needs to be done. But the day-to-day things that we are beginning to hear from leadership have been more directed towards a concern for who's going to be the next generation of leaders inside the department. And the fact that there are some places, although it does appear just very basically to be not as much of a majority situation as maybe, you know, again, anecdotally, you would think it would be. But there are some agencies that are fulfilling those positions in a manner that may be inconsistent with what you would consider succession planning. They're putting people into a sergeant role that maybe they're not preparing them for just yet. And that creates a much different organizational environment than we've ever seen. You know, as you know, Jim, there are some folks that are entering the role of sergeant that may be underprepared for that role. So we're really intrigued about where this is happening. What are some of the organizational underpinnings of that policy, and what's the effect of that?
Yeah, I can't wait to see that. Michael Rossler, Department of Criminal Justice Studies at Illinois State University. Thanks for being on. What are you working on?
Yeah, it's my pleasure. So I work a lot with Charlie, so it's nice to see what's on the horizon for us, because he's always looking forward. We're looking at some recent research we did was looking at why officers are interested in transferring departments. So I think so often there's been an examination of why they leave the field. We want to know what might prompt them to go to a different agency but stay within the field of policing. And then we're looking at just some general retention things and trying to predict why officers are staying or leaving in the profession as a whole. And then a third thing that I'm working on kind of outside of there is the roles and responsibilities of conservation law enforcement. So officers who enforce fish and wildlife laws and what their day-to-day work operations look like.
Nice.
He's more interested in that because of his recreational activities outside of research.
Yeah, definitely. I have a soft spot in my heart for conservation.
He doesn't want to display the trophy bucks behind him on the wall.
Yeah, I would like to know where they're hiding, but just kidding.
Kill two birds. Well, a hint, Mike, is the $30,000 to $75,000 bonuses. That's why they're transferring. So, Jacob Foster, doctoral student, good luck going forward with that. You're at Arizona State, and what do you have on your horizon?
Yeah, first I want to say I really appreciate having us on, you know, on air, Jim. Right now I'm in my third year. I'm working on my dissertation. It focuses on kind of this link between, you know, officer use of force training and their behavior. So I'm really looking at, you know, how maybe certain types of training may impact how officers, you know, respond to certain types of resistances. So I'm really adding more to the literature. That there have been studies, you know, on in-service training. There's been actually really good studies on it. Few and far between. They're just more limited right now. So I'd like to add more to that. So hope to get that done and hopefully get my doctorate in the next year.
Great. Yeah. We've had Dr. Eric Pisa from John Jay on the show, and he talked about use of force encounters and the actions leading up to them by both the officers and the subject. So that interesting one there. Good luck with that.
Thank you.
All right, gentlemen, thanks for taking the time today. And to our listeners, hope you enjoyed the show. Check out the article in our link at the end of show notes and the full bios of our three guests today. Great work. Love to see it happening. And hopefully, if you're contacted to participate in a study, that you jump at the chance to talk to gentlemen like these and get the word out and on information that we need to know in the profession. Hey, thanks for looking at us and listening to us, and stay safe out there. Hope to talk to you again real soon. Take good care.